Hey friends, before we get started, I wanted to call out to all of our international listeners. This episode is going to focus heavily on the US perspective of the World Cup, but I think it relates to any nation. So whether you're in Australia, Mexico, or England, I know the World Cup is a special moment to wrestle with the same positive and negative emotions that come with the global tournament. I'm also working on an upcoming episode about books and book covers, so please let me know your favorite book cover design and what you look for when picking out a book to read. You can do that by leaving a voicemail at www.speakpipe.com/leastimportantthings or visiting our website at leastimportantthings.com and clicking the Leave a Voicemail button. You can email the show at leastimportantthings@gmail.com or reach out to me on Instagram or Twitter at Luke H. Ferris or Least Important Things on Facebook. Okay, that's enough of me until you get more of me. On with the episode. Every 4 years, for 1 month, the world stops and collectively engages in the most profound event on planet Earth, the FIFA World Cup. The 2022 men's edition is upon us in an unlikely place and time, with geopolitical pressures clouding the event's clarity of international competition. But don't expect anything less than a global obsession to interfere with this tournament, because the U.S. men's national team has returned after an embarrassing previous cycle where they failed to qualify for the 2018 World Cup. Led by a slew of young stars like Christian Pulisic, Tyler Adams, Brendan Aaronson, Weston McKennie, and Gio Reyna, the team has never been as talented or globally respected for their accomplishments in Europe's top leagues. For many of you, watching the World Cup is a passive act. Similar to the Olympic sports, you probably pay attention every 4 years to the men's and women's tournaments, and then go back with your normal lives until the next installment. That's totally okay. It's how most diehard fans, especially in the US, got hooked on the beautiful game. But that's changing. Soccer is becoming one of the most popular sports in America, especially in the 18 to 35-year-old demographic. NBC Sports signed a multi-billion dollar deal to broadcast the English Premier League in the U.S., and Apple Plus will exclusively distribute the American Men's Pro League, MLS, starting in 2023. Funny enough, America is actually the best place to live in the world if you're a soccer fan, because you have the ability to easily stream matches from Germany, Spain, Mexico, and South America with a tap of a button. Even one of the most popular TV shows in the last 2 years, the Emmy-winning Ted Lasso, is about an American college football coach managing a Premier League club.
Because I promise you, there is something worse out there than being sad, and that is being alone and being sad.
But as impressive as the growth of the club game is in America, the World Cup still reigns supreme, here and all over. According to Statista, the 2018 World Cup final had 517 million viewers across the globe, compared to 140 million viewers for Super Bowl 56. Interestingly enough, in the U.S., the Hollywood Reporter shared that the 2019 Women's World Cup final between the U.S. and Netherlands drew just about 14 million viewers. That's actually 12% higher than the 12 million for the 2018 final between France and Croatia. So why is the World Cup so popular? What does it say about the changing landscapes in sports fandom? And why should you tune in this year? Welcome to a podcast called Least Important Things. I'm your host, Luke Ferris. My love affair with soccer, as we call it here in the United States, or football globally, started at the impressionable period of my teens. I wasn't a soccer player growing up like many of my suburbanite friends. My wide shoulders, thick torso, and giraffe legs were better suited for smash-and-grab American sports like football and basketball. But something always interested me about the game of soccer. My first lasting memory of soccer was watching the 1999 Women's World Cup final in the living room of my friend Alex's house.
Chastain will take it.
The final was hosted at the Rose Bowl and went down to a penalty shootout, with Brandi Chastain scoring the kick to send the U.S. to glory.
She missed a penalty kick against China in the Algarve Cup, and they lost that game. Go!
Her celebration is one of the most iconic moments in American sports history. Then in 2002, my older brother and his friends woke up at the crack of dawn to watch the U.S. play Germany in the World Cup quarterfinals held in South Korea. The U.S. fatally lost via uncalled German handball, but it was one of the best modern runs in the tournament for the U.S. men. I was intrigued and jealous of my brother being able to watch this strange sport that was captivating our small corner of West Michigan that summer. In 2006, my intrigue had become an obsession. Thanks to Sports Illustrated for Kids World Cup Preview Edition, I was able to study each team, the players, the jerseys, to be fully prepared for a summer of watching soccer on my couch. I still remember running into my yard, tears pouring down my face when the U.S. bowed out of the group stage versus Ghana.
Ghana are in control again.
From then on, my obsession with soccer became my identity. I started following an English club via internet scores. I researched leagues, stadiums, fan culture, and the history of the game. It felt like my own little secret hobby. I'd unlocked a world of sports culture, endlessly rich and vast. It's kind of like eating normal Cheerios your whole childhood, and then discovering that there's a thing called frosted mini Cheerios. I began to wear my soccer obsession as a badge. I'd sport jerseys to school, slap poorly laser-printed, pixelated pictures of star players on my bedroom wall, and then proselytize about promotion relegation to whatever poor soul sat next to me at the lunch table. For proof, here's an audio clip of me from my high school broadcasting class doing a Man on the Street segment about the 2010 World Cup.
Hey everybody, I'm Luke Ferris, and I'm going to see how much Eastern knows about the World Cup, FIFA 2010 World Cup. Let's go see. Hey, do you know when where the World Cup is being played this year?
I do not.
Do you know who won the 2006 FIFA World Cup?
Huh?
Do you know who won the 2006 FIFA World Cup?
Huh?
Do you know any U.S. soccer players? Can you name a few?
Little did I know that while I recruited my classmates to watch the U.S. matches together in crowded air-conditioned basements that summer, a fellow soccer nerd and future friend was thousands of miles away, sitting in the stands in South Africa.
My name is Logan Matthews. So I was at the World Cup in 2010 in South Africa. So my older brother and I went to that together. First story highlights just how the World Cup is such a global event. So I was there, South Africa's hosting. I think they played, I believe it was Mexico in the first game of that World Cup. And we had kind of been traveling to see part of the country. So we just found a kind of an official FIFA fan zone kind of away from Johannesburg where we were.
Mudesa turning it through. It's on here now. The goalkeeper's beaten and South Africa have their first goal. Sipiwe Shabalala.
And we were there and South Africa scores the opening goal of the tournament. And this beautiful South African man who I've never met before in my life comes running up to this random American and cigarette in his mouth and just jumps in my arms. And I give him a hug and like twirl him around like we're on a dance floor. And it's like, what is going on here other than just the glory of the World Cup? I mean, you guys knew me in college. I'm not necessarily the most unreserved man. So just to be like giving a random hug to a stranger and my brother couldn't believe it. Anyway, but it's just like the joy of being a host country, especially, but also just different cultures coming together is fantastic. So that was one. And then I was also at the Landon Donovan Algeria game.
Saifi with a header. Howard gratefully claims it. Distribution, brilliant. Landon Donovan, there are things on here for the USA. Can they do it here? Cross, and Dempsey's denied again, but Donovan has scored! Oh, can you believe this? Go, go, USA! Certainly through! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
I actually, don't remember that moment as much as I remember the celebration. What happened on the field, it was just like, I only remember that from the TV now, but the celebration in the stands was just fantastic. More random hugging and just going crazy. And then we got in a car and we went to a Germany game afterwards later in the evening. So great day.
Logan and I met in college. He was an upperclassman when I was a freshman. He spotted me out of a crowd one night because I was wearing my American Outlaws t-shirt, which is the official supporters group of U.S. soccer. It's kind of like an adult student section. Quickly, we started talking about soccer, his travels to the World Cup, and everything in between. After we both graduated, Logan and I reconnected thanks to a mutual friend, Rob, who started a group text called My Only Soccer Watching Friends. For 7 years, we've discussed, debated, and commiserated about our shared club team, Tottenham Hotspur, the United States teams, and just life in general. Rob played soccer in high school, but it was in the early days of the game's popularity when it was difficult to watch club matches on TV. So the World Cup was the major moment to engage with global soccer.
Hi, my name is Rob Burkheiser. I've been friends with Luke since like 2010.
Give me your favorite World Cup watch memory.
My family was vacationing in Silver Lake Sand Dunes, Michigan. And I was like surfing down these sand dunes, like snowboarding on sand. And my mom was like, oh, I want to try that. And she tried it and she broke her leg in half. And oh, we had to get like medical boat to take her to the road to get her in an ambulance to go to the Muskegon hospital. And then like my sister and I showed up to the hospital the next day, and it was the day of, was it France, Italy?
Yeah. The final 2006.
And so my mom's like casted up, she's in a bed. My whole family's just sitting next to her. She's kind of resting. She's doing fine. And then Zidane headbutts.
He's just headed Materazzi in the middle of the chest. What was Zidane thinking of? Zinedine Zidane's career ends with being sent off in the World Cup final.
I had it on in the hospital room and I freaked out. I was like, oh my gosh, woke my mom up from her slumber. She was so angry. Like I was supposed to be like grieving for her broken leg or something, but I was like, the World Cup's on.
Shortly after our group chat Discord started, Rob recruited one of his friends to join our chatterbox of the global game.
My name's Tucker Bidding. So I was not like a huge soccer fan for like most of my life. I didn't play soccer, wasn't really into it. But I started playing FIFA because I love video games, but didn't really have like a team or anything, wasn't following anybody from Premier League. And then in 2016, I met Rob. We found a connection and a love through FIFA. And that's when he introduced me to Tottenham. It was kind of a weird story. I mean, I never was really into soccer other than just playing the video game because I enjoyed it. And met a crazy friend, and the rest is kind of history. So
did you feel like the FIFA experience lived up to the like watching on TV? Because that's a big gap for some people.
If FIFA was anything like real life, I'd be making a lot more money as one of the top managers in the world. and I stand by that.
Did you ever grow up watching the World Cup? Were you like one of those people that like every 4 years, but like, so like, what was your, like one of your best memories of watching the World Cup after you got into soccer?
Logan reminded me when he was talking about being in South Africa and just having some random person come up to him, hug him when South Africa scored. So in 2010, in the summer, I was in Brazil with Athletes in Action on a volleyball tour. And we were there during the World Cup. And we happened to be at this little, like, I don't even remember what this place was. It was like a community center we got connected with that did some like local outreach and stuff. We were like up, we got off like a main highway outside of, I think, Sao Paulo. And we were like up in the hills, and Brazil was playing the one night and we couldn't watch it. Like we didn't have like a TV up there to watch it. But one of the guys who was up there, who was, Brazilian, like was tracking it, and they scored, and you could just hear like people like cheering and like setting off fireworks and doing all this stuff like in these little villages like down the hill.
That's pretty amazing.
It was unbelievable. And we were just sitting up there like, oh my gosh, they must have scored. But it was crazy. They were just like popping off fireworks and screaming and yelling, doing all this stuff. It was wild. Like the energy was crazy there.
Our group is a fascinating mix of my generation's attraction to the game. Some through playing it or through the FIFA video game, others a family connection or cultural upbringing, or like me, people with a strange obsession with non-American sports culture. No matter how you've fallen in love with soccer, one way or another, a World Cup memory is part of the story. So here are some of your favorite memories. Cameron said, when Deuce, Clint Dempsey, scored against Ghana in 2014, I jumped on a table at a restaurant and they threatened to kick me out. Caitlin said, following the World Cup while I was living in Spain. They didn't do very well that year. I believe that was 2014 when Spain was the defending World Cup champions and lost in the first round of the knockout stage. Jake said the insane amount of vuvuzelas in 2010. Dana said not my favorite, but memorable was, of course, the same as Rob, when Zinedine Zidane headbutted Maserati in 2006. Matt said Robin van Persie's Flying Dutchman header goal. Peter said, this prompt got the Shakira song from South Africa stuck in my head. Audrey said, Shakira's Waka Waka song and dance in 2010. Apparently Shakira, not the football, was the most memorable part of that tournament. Bennett said Landon Donovan's goal versus Algeria, of course. And Mike, a good friend of the show and also my co-host over at Jurassic Pod, shares a memory of that same match versus Algeria.
I remember in 2009 when the United States competed in the Confederations Cup in South Africa, and all the news was buzzing about the United States men having beaten Spain. We're going to play Brazil. And that got me really interested in the U.S. men's national team. So I watched that game against Brazil, and even though they lost, I was really excited for the World Cup the next year. And when the World Cup came around, I was watching every game religiously. I knew I had studied the roster. I was taking time out of my day, but nobody else that I knew was doing this. It was just me. And I just remember celebrating alone in my living room when Landon Donovan scored the goal against Algeria to send the United States through. And I screamed at the top of my lungs and I tore off my shirt. I ran down the street of my neighborhood and nobody else was doing anything. And I just thought, am I the only one that just witnessed the greatest sports moment in United States soccer history? And that's when I fell in love with soccer.
What makes the World Cup so captivating? Sure, it's scarcity, but it's more than that. Unlike the Olympics, the World Cup is a singular event, just soccer. It's also a simple game. It doesn't take much brain power to get involved. If your team kicks the ball in the other team's net, cheer. I think the most common denominator of the World Cup is unifying behind one team. In a nation that seems more divided than ever, to cheer on one American team, no matter your race, identity, politics, income, or college football affiliation, it's a scarce moment in our culture. For a few weeks, every American can come under the banner of unity, whether in tears or in celebration. Now, this year's World Cup is one of the most controversial. For one, it's being played in November and December, and that's thanks to the host nation, Qatar or Qatar. Between the horrible accounts of migrant working conditions to build the state-of-the-art climate-controlled stadiums in the middle of the desert, and the publicized corruption surrounding how the minuscule oil nation was awarded the tournament, this World Cup has a big old asterisk on it. We're not going to dive too deep into this. There's been some incredible journalism on it, so feel free to learn more on your own. I suggest listening to the Men in Blazers Crooked Media World Corrupt series for a comprehensive backstory of how Qatar was awarded this year's World Cup. Unfortunately, the corruption surrounding the World Cup and global sporting events like the Olympics isn't new. From the 1936 Olympics in Berlin to the most recent Men's World Cup in Russia, these events are often bastardized by power-hungry leaders looking to piggyback on eyeballs as propaganda tools for their own national agendas. And the organizations that host these events, FIFA and the IOC, are more than happy to greedily take bribes and turn eyes to ensure that they happen. The moral dilemma for an average fan will be even harder to stomach this year. And there's a fair argument about how these tournaments and events actually do more harm than good for the vulnerable populations of the host nations. Plus, global tournaments have a track record to be a pressure cooker for nationalism. Just look at the most recent European men's tournament final in London as an example.
Fueled by alcohol and drugs, a violent and ticketless mob numbering 2,000 tailgated, stormed disabled gates or fire exits, and broke into the stadium.
It's a challenge. For every negative argument, there's a positive argument. For every minority act of nationalism, there are moments of global unity, especially when the Irish are in the tournament. For every act of sports washing, there are millions of funds invested into the opportunities for underprivileged children. For every glorified superstar, there's always a moment of human triumph over tragedy. Are the shared memories of hugging a complete stranger at a watch party, or tearful pats on the back from your best friend after a missed penalty kick, worth it all? I'm not sure. It feels like an impossible dichotomy as a sports fan and a fan of soccer. But in actuality, the World Cup is just a reflection of humanity, both the good and the bad, wrapped up into a three-week circus. If you do watch the World Cup this year, I implore you to embrace the beauty that cuts through the dark side of our humanity. How in just 90 minutes of anticipation, anxiety, and ecstasy, you can stand next to a fellow American and say together, "Go, go, USA." Least Important Things is a podcast about the most important of the least important things in pop culture and entertainment. It's hosted and created by me, Luke Ferris, and executive produced by Jay Ferris. Logo and brand design by Curtis Felton. There was so much left on the cutting room floor on this episode. Specifically, I want to call out my passion for the women's national team. Unlike the men's team, our U.S. women have been the most dominant team on the globe. In recent years, they've had to fight for equal pay, proper facilities, and battle abusive treatment in the domestic league, all while having the unobtainable expectations of perfection. They will be playing in the World Cup next summer in Australia and New Zealand, so get excited for that. If you want to find out more about the women's team and the women's game in general and its growth and change over the last 20 years, I highly suggest reading the work of the Athletic journalist Meg Linehan and Steph Yang. I've also written an article on my top 10 favorite U.S. World Cup moments from the men's and women's teams. You can read that and the rest of our articles at leastimportantthings.com. And until next time, thanks for listening.